Thank you. Is that okay? Okay. Yeah, I'd like to thank Amer for inviting me here to come to speak to you today. I first got involved in this, the field of measuring optical frequencies in 1994. And at that time, the only way to measure optical frequencies was with a sophisticated optical frequency chain. The comb didn't arrive for another 6 years or so. It was an exciting time, though, because the chains had extended up to visible optical frequencies, and people were starting to look at other ways of measuring frequency besides the chains themselves. During this talk, I'll give you some of the history of the measurement of optical frequencies and describe some of the important developments that were made along the way. I come from the National Metrology Institute for Canada, and so I'm a metrologist, and we look at things probably differently than a lot of you do. We're interested in measurement, but we really focus a lot on uncertainty still. You hear me mentioning the word uncertainty a lot during this talk. So what are optical frequencies? For the purpose of the talk, I'll define them as frequencies between 10 to the 12 and 10 to the 15 hertz. These are high frequencies. They're visible frequencies are about a factor of 50,000 times higher than the cesium standard, which is the basis of the second in the International System of Units, the SI. It's around 10 gigahertz. They're much higher also than the what can be measured with commercial frequency counters, which top out at a few tens of gigahertz. So why do we want to measure optical frequencies? Much of the early work was focused on two main objectives: to improve the measurements of the speed of light and to develop a better standard for the meter. Now, modern applications of measuring optical frequencies include the calibration of lasers that are used in dimensional metrology and in optical telecommunications. A calibrated optical standard can also serve as a recognized secondary realization of the second, and also as wavelength standards for spectroscopy or for measuring length. Now, we expect that maybe in 10 years or so, we'll redefine the second in terms of an optical standard, and in that case, we're going to have to be able to measure optical frequencies in order to fix that value, and then also to be able to use that new standard to measure other optical frequencies and RF frequencies. Finally, optical frequency measurements have been used for measurements of fundamental physical constants and tests of their stability. Now, the early work was focused on these two objectives, so I'm going to focus on that for the next couple slides. The speed of light was measured for over 300 years, gradually improving in its value. The early measurements by Romer and Bradley used astronomical observations, and later ones by Fizeau-Foucault, Cornu, and Michelson used rotating mirrors and shutters in order to measure directly the speed of light over fairly long baselines. The best measurements going into the 1970s were from Essen and Gordon Smith and Frum that were from the National Physical Lab in the UK. And they measured both the wavelength and the frequency of light and then derived the speed of light from this simple relation here. The first meter was adopted by the French Academy of Sciences in 1791. And chosen to be equal to 1/10 millionth of the distance between the North Pole and the equator through the meridian through Paris. Part of that meridian was surveyed between 1792 and 1798, and a platinum meter bar was produced, which was placed in the French National Archives, and it served as the meter for France and was later adopted by several other countries as the meter. At the first meter convention conference in 1875, they decided to establish a permanent International Bureau for Weights and Measures, which is the BIPM in Paris. And the BIPM fairly quickly set out to make over a dozen meter bar standards, and they chose one whose length was closest to this meter that was held in the French National Archives. And in 1889, at the first General Conference for Weights and Measures, that bar was chosen as the international prototype meter, and it remained the meter standard until 1960. It was fairly early recognized that maybe a wavelength standard would be a better standard for the meter, And in 1893, Michelson and Benoit measured the red spectral line of cadmium. And in 1927, that cadmium line was made a wavelength standard for spectroscopy with a fixed value or fixed wavelength measured in angstroms. Several other wavelength standards were investigated over the years. And in 1960, at the 11th General Conference for Weights and Measures, they adopted this definition for the meter. And it was defined in terms of the, I think the orange-red, maybe it's orange line of krypton 86. However, this standard was fairly quickly to be realized to be kind of insufficient because the line was asymmetric. And this, along with practical problems in doing the interferometry, meant that you couldn't realize the standard to better than about 4 parts in 10 to the 9. So you could never measure another wavelength better or know its frequency better or its wavelength better than 4 parts in 10 to the 9. The second, however, though, was redefined in 1967 in terms of a microwave transition in the cesium-133 atom. And even in 1967, it could be realized with an uncertainty of 1 part in 10 to the 12, which is about a factor of 1,000 better than the meter could be realized. So this was the situation with the speed of light and the meter. The speed of light should be remeasured or measured more precisely because better values were needed for measuring for measuring distance over astronomical distances and even on the Earth. And the meter was insufficient because it could only be realized to 4 parts in 10 to the 9, whereas the second could be realized to about 3 orders of magnitude better uncertainty. So therefore, what we needed was some device for connecting optical frequencies to the second, and that device was the optical frequency chain. Probably the simplest optical frequency chain is a harmonic chain, which is shown here. This consists of a series of intermediate oscillators with increasing frequency that connect the cesium time standard, often 5 megahertz from it, to an optical frequency standard. At each step or link in the chain, a harmonic mixer is used to create a harmonic of the lower frequency standard and mix it with a frequency from the higher frequency standard. The resulting beat frequency could then just be counted, or it could be used as part of a frequency or phase lock. These types of chains could either be continuous, and by that I mean that the entire chain was, all the parts were operated simultaneously, or it could be a broken chain or a discontinuous chain, in which case some of these oscillators had to be locked to atomic or molecular transitions. So there were two technologies which made optical frequency chains possible. The first was the laser and methods to stabilize its frequency. The laser was a truly enabling technology because not only was it used in the chains itself, but it was the impetus for measuring optical frequencies in the first place. Because why would you want to measure an optical frequency, go to all the trouble to build a chain, if that frequency wasn't stable and reproducible? The other technology that made chains possible was the ultra-high frequency harmonic mixer. And I'll go over these things in the next few slides. In the early 1970s, it was possible to stabilize lasers through several processes, such as saturated absorption or Doppler-free spectroscopy, lambda stabilization, and fluorescent stabilization. Probably the most common was the saturated absorption spectroscopy, and achieved the best uncertainty values for standards. In contrast to normal laser spectroscopy, where a single laser beam is used to scan across an absorption line in a low-pressure gas and then shows a Doppler broadened profile, in saturated absorption spectroscopy, the laser beam is divided into two parts, which travel through the sample in opposite directions. The stronger probe beam partially saturates the absorption, and then the probe beam, which goes in the other direction, measures the resulting transmission. Both of the lasers, you have to remember, at the same frequency. So the resulting Doppler broadened profile here shows a tiny little feature called, we refer to it as a saturated absorption or Doppler-free feature. and it can have a very narrow line width of below 1 megahertz. So if you modulate the laser frequency at some frequency and then demodulate it with a lock-in amplifier, you obtain an assigned error signal, which can then be used to lock this laser up. So that's how saturated absorption spectroscopy was used to lock lasers. So from a metrology point of view, probably the most important of these lasers was the helium neon laser at 633 nanometers. That's the one that's in the labs often, in the undergrad labs. Same wavelength, but it's stabilized to transitions in iodine. And this laser was first reported by Haynes and Dahlstrom from NRC, and it went on to become the most important laser for laser metrology because, or for wavelength metrology, and for measuring length, and also it serves as the practical meter standard for many countries in the world, even to this day. This is a photograph of Al Madej, who some of you may know, working in our lab with our ensemble of three of these lasers. If this laser is properly built and designed and operated according to certain prescription, it'll realize a recommended frequency with an uncertainty of only 2 parts in 10 to the 11. Now, the other technology that made change possible was the high-frequency harmonic mixer. Several of these are, I've listed the main ones here. Metal-to-semiconductor diodes and Josephson junction diodes were able to generate very high harmonics, but unfortunately they topped out at around 4 terahertz in their response. By far the most important harmonic mixer used in chains was the metal insulator metal, or MIM, diode, which was capable of generating and mixing harmonics all the way up to 150 or 200 terahertz, and that corresponds to about 1,500 nanometers in wavelength. The beat frequencies produced by these harmonic mixers could be just a simple difference between the laser to be measured and a harmonic of the of a lower frequency laser, or it could be a combination of harmonics of at least two or even more lasers, and you'll see some how complex some of these beats were if you look closely at some of my slides. They had several shortcomings. They had low sensitivity often, and that meant the signals could be small and the signal to noise could be small. They were fragile and easily burnt out, and they had a frequency coverage that extended up to only about 200 or 150 terahertz, which meant they couldn't be used into the visible. So this is a diagram of a tungsten nickel MIM diode. In our laboratory, they used a tungsten whisker that was a 25 micron tungsten wire that was electrochemically sharpened to an atomically sharp tip. And that tip was then pressed against a single crystal nickel post on which a natural oxide layer had formed about 1 nanometer thick. The laser radiation was then focused directly onto the tip. There's two mechanisms that were thought to be responsible for the operation of these devices. At higher frequencies, it's thought that the main mechanism was electron tunneling through the thin asymmetric potential that formed in the oxide layer between the two metals, the tungsten and the nickel, which had different work functions. And at lower frequencies, thermionic field emission became important. So this is a photo of one of the NRC tungsten nickel MIM diodes as it appeared on the cover of Physics Today in January 1983. The same edition had an article by Mac Baird of our lab. If you look closely, you can see the nickel post and a little bit of the tungsten whisker. This is a lens for focusing the CO2 laser radiation onto the tip. And there's a microwave waveguide here for bringing in power from a klystron. So the first measurement of an optical frequency with a frequency chain was reported by Javin's group at MIT in 1967. This is a diagram of their chain. They measured the frequency of a hydrogen cyanide laser around 900 gigahertz. To do that, they used a commercial silicon cat's whisker mixer and compared the frequency of this laser to the 12th or 13th harmonic of a 75 gigahertz klystron. And then they measured the frequency of the klystron against the 7th harmonic of a 11 gigahertz oscillator, and then that oscillator was phase locked to a calibrated signal generator. They obtained an uncertainty of about 1 part in 10 to the 7. That's probably because their lasers weren't stabilized. So this is the first optical frequency chain that ever extended from a cesium standard all the way up to well into the infrared. Barger and Hall had previously developed a helium neon laser that was stabilized through saturated absorption onto lines in methane. And they found that this laser had very small systematic shifts, and it was very reproducible in its frequency. And this laser went on to become probably the most important optical standard during the era of the chains. So their chain was set up to measure the frequency of this laser. It was very complicated, as you can see. It used 5 types of lasers, 6 klystrons, 2 silicon contact mixers, and 4 tungsten nickel MIM mixers. It worked in 3 steps, so it was a discontinuous chain. In the first step, it measured the frequency of this stabilized CO2 laser. Next step, it measured the frequency of this stabilized laser. And then in the final step, it measured the frequency of this methane-stabilized helium neon laser against the third harmonic of the CO2 laser. So this is their result. They made they also made measurements of the wavelength of this laser by Barger and Hall. And then the combining these two results together gave them a new value for the speed of light, which was better than previous measurements. I should go back. This type of chain that I've shown here was not copied, but it was the model that was used for many other chains that were built around the world. And all these used these very large, long, far infrared lasers in order to connect the microwaves to the frequency of the CO2 lasers, around 30 terahertz. Now, at NRC, we decided to develop another type of chain in which these far infrared lasers were replaced by the frequency differences between similar lasers. And this had several advantages. It used only CO2 lasers, which were considerably shorter. They were only about a meter long. And CO2 has many transitions that are spaced by only about 60 gigahertz. And this means that you can reconfigure this type of chain so it can be configured to measure almost any optical frequency up to the 150 terahertz limit of the harmonic mixers. So this is a diagram of the NRC chain as it stood in the late 1970s. It was developed by Brad Whitford in our lab. It's not as complicated as it looks. What they did first was they locked this 71 gigahertz klystron to the cesium time standard, and then they measured the difference in frequency between a laser operating on the R30 transition and one operating on the P6 transition against the 11th harmonic of that klystron. Then they used that frequency difference to measure this frequency difference. Then they used that frequency difference to measure this frequency difference. So each time, the frequency difference got wider to the point where they could finally measure the frequency of a CO2 laser against the fourth harmonic of that final frequency difference here. And after they'd done that and measured another laser, the system of equations closed, and the frequencies of all the CO2 lasers was then known. So they were able then to measure the frequency of the methane-stabilized laser. Mac Baird and company measured its wavelength, and then by combining these two results together, they arrived at a value for the speed of light, which is incredibly close to the modern value. Now, what effect did these measurements have on the speed of light and the meter? In 1973, the Consultative Committee for the Definition of the Meter considered the measurement that had been done at National Bureau of Standards, along with some wavelength measurements, and recommended to the CIPM, which was the International Committee for Weights and Measures, that the value of the speed of light should be this value with an uncertainty of 4 times 10 to the minus 9. And that's dominated entirely by the Krypton standard for the meter. Over the next 10 years, there were other measurements of the methane-stabilized helium neon laser frequency and wavelength, as well as some measurements of CO2 lasers. And in 1983, the 17th General Conference on Weights and Measures adopted this new definition for the SI meter, and this is the definition that's still in place today. As a consequence of this definition, the speed of light is fixed, and it has this value exactly. Another consequence is that if you have an optical standard and you measure its frequency, you then know its wavelength to the same relative, or its vacuum wavelength to the same relative uncertainty. So the chain at NRC evolved over the years, and the discontinuous chain that I showed earlier, where the lasers had to be locked to atomic and molecular transitions, was replaced by this chain. In this chain, all of the lasers and microwave oscillators were simultaneously phase-locked to a cesium-referenced hydrogen maser signal. It used four lasers, A, B, C, and D, all CO2 lasers, and two microwave oscillators. And when all the phase lock loops were closed, these mixing equations were all exact, and the frequencies of all the lasers were then were fixed, and they all had the same long-term accuracy or uncertainty as the cesium-referenced hydrogen maser. So this is a photo of that chain. It was housed in a concrete bunker in the basement of our building and normally only operated in the evening or in, at night when everybody had left the building. You can see the four main CO2 lasers and then another auxiliary one that's used for some other measurements. At the other end of the table are the optics for mixing the various CO2 laser beams and putting them onto the point contact diodes. And I think there's six of them across the back there. And this is part of the electronics that was used for locking up the chain. And this doesn't look as complicated after seeing some of the labs I visited today. So. Now, as the our ability to measure optical frequencies with chains improved, so also did the optical standards themselves. During the 1980s and 90s, techniques were developed for trapping atoms and ions and cooling them to millikelvin temperatures. It was if we could build a standard then based on one of using these techniques, it'd be possible to isolate the atoms from collisions and the atom would essentially be in an unperturbed state. And so it would make a very good optical standard. It was proposed that such optical standards would eventually reach uncertainties approaching parts in 10 to the 18. So this is a photograph. What we did at NRC was we chose to develop a optical frequency standard based on a single-trapped and laser-cooled strontium ion. And this is a photograph of that trap. Now, the strontium ion energy partial energy level diagram is shown here. It's laser cooled at 422 nanometers on this electric dipole transition. Sufficient light is scattered that you can detect the scattered light with a photomultiplier. The clock transition is an electric quadrupole transition between the S1/2 and the D5/2 state at 674 nanometers or 445 terahertz, and has a line Q of about 10 to the 15. So it's a very narrow line. This is the spectrum. It actually contains five pairs of Zeeman components, and the line center is defined to be at this the center frequency here. The spectrum is measured through the method of quantum jumps, through the electron shelving method. When the atom absorbs a photon at 674 nanometers and makes a transition to the D5/2 state, the fluorescence or the scattering stops, and it only returns once the atom is decayed back down to the S1/2 state. So using the quantum jump method, it's possible to detect the absorption of a single photon by a single ion with almost 100% efficiency and measure the spectrum. And this is one showing a line width of only about 4 hertz. So this is the laser that that we used to make that measurement. It's our clock laser. It's locked to an ultra-stable cavity that's housed in another concrete bunker. And this is Pierre Debay, who some of you have met, working on that laser. Its frequency is shifted into resonance with the ion by means of an acousto-optic modulator, which is under computer control. So the computer measures the quantum jump rates at four frequencies, one on each side of two of a pair of Zeeman components, and uses an algorithm then to determine the shift of the line center from of the ions clock frequency line center from the unshifted laser frequency. The laser frequency is also sent off to either the chain in the old days or the comb nowadays to measure its optical frequency. So back in the late 1990s, we modified or we added to our chain so that we could extend it into the visible. And this is the resulting chain. You can see the trapped ion standard up here. A divide by three system, which used frequency conversion in bulk nonlinear crystals, was used to phase lock a thulium YAG laser at 148 terahertz, it was 2 microns, to the ultra stable laser at 445 terahertz. Then the frequency of that thulium YAG laser was measured against the fifth harmonic of a CO2 laser, and it was measured with the NRC frequency chain. So this chain, every part on it operated simultaneously, so it was a continuous chain, and it was one of only two chains in the world ever, continuous chains, to ever extend all the way from the cesium standard up to the visible in a single continuous chain. We were able to obtain about 3 hours of good data over a period of about a year, and so it gives you a bit of an idea how difficult it was to operate, but anyways, we obtained an uncertainty of about 200 hertz for 5 parts in 10 to the 13. So soon after that measurement was completed, we used it to measure the frequency of the iodine-stabilized helium neon laser at 633 nanometers. This laser, as I mentioned, is very important for length measurement, and it had only been measured once previously to high accuracy, and that was done by a French group with a two-part chain, I think, in 1992, so we wanted to measure it again. It happens that the frequency difference between the strontium ion and the helium neon laser is equal to the frequency of a CO2 laser, and so this chain was used to measure the frequency of that CO2 laser. Lasers from the BIPM and JILA, which is at University of Colorado, participated in these measurements, and these measurements served as a validation of the optical frequency comb, which had just been built in John Hall's lab at JILA. So frequency chains could extend into the visible, but they were very difficult to build and to operate, and they were often designed to just measure one optical frequency. So people started to look for alternatives, and I'm going to describe a few of them in the next few slides. So probably the most promising alternative to the frequency chain was the optical frequency interval divider. This was proposed by Tella in 1990 and built into an operating system at Ted Hansch's group at the Max Planck Institute, or MPQ, in Munich, Germany. The idea here is that laser 3 is frequency doubled in a crystal, and phase lock to the sum frequency of lasers 1 and 2. In this way, the frequency of laser 3 is exactly in the middle of the frequencies of lasers 1 and 2. So if you have a frequency interval, you can apply several of these stages to divide it down to the point where it could be measured with conventional electronics. This device had several positive features. It used only one type of laser. Or it could be designed to use one type of laser, such as an extended cavity diode laser. Could be designed to use just one type of crystal, and it stayed in the visible, so you didn't need infrared lasers or far infrared lasers. So the MPQ group used a 5-stage frequency interval divider to measure the frequency of the 1s to 2s 2-photon transition in hydrogen. And from their measurements, they were able to combine them with some other measurements, I think of the N equals 8 level in hydrogen, and they came up with a better value for the Rydberg constant and also the Lamb shift of the 1s level. Now, the practicality of this optical frequency interval divider was limited because if you had fairly large intervals that you wanted to divide down, it would take a lot of steps. So people started to look for alternatives that would span larger frequencies all in one go. And one of those was the optical frequency comb generator. This was developed at the Tokyo Institute of Technology in, I think, the early 1990s. The idea here is you take a continuous wave laser and send it into a resonant optical cavity which contains an electro-optic modulator. And the electro-optic modulator puts sidebands onto the laser with a spacing equal to the modulation frequency. And since this is inside a cavity, the interaction is very strong, and you get a very broad comb through a cascade process. So this comb can extend up to about 10 terahertz. So you can use it to measure the frequency difference between two lasers, as I've shown here. So what you need to do is you measure the beat frequencies between each of these lasers and nearby comb elements. And then you also need to know how many comb elements are between the two lasers. And that can be measured with a rough measurement of the two frequencies with a wave meter. And then knowing the number of comb elements, the modulation frequency, and the two beat frequencies, you can then calculate the laser frequency difference. So the MPQ group modified their divider that I showed two slides ago and replaced the four lower parts of the, or four lower stages of frequency interval dividers with a single optical frequency comb generator. And they used this to measure the isotope shift between deuterium and hydrogen of the 1s to 2s 2-photon transition. And from that, they were able to determine the deuteron radius with an uncertainty. It was about a factor of 10 better than had been previously measured with electron scattering experiments. So you can also get a comb of frequencies from a mode-lock laser. This was known since about the 1960s that a spectrum of the pulses from a mode-lock laser consists of a regular comb of frequencies with a spacing equal to the laser repetition frequency. The first application of that was probably by Eckstein, Ferguson, and Hansch, who used a picosecond laser to measure the fine splitting in sodium. As years, towards the late 1990s, femtosecond mode-lock lasers became available, and these could span very broad, they generated very broad combs. The group at MPQ measured a frequency difference of 18.4 terahertz, which was 244,000 comb modes, and that was even improved upon by Jan Hall's group at JILA, who used a comb to measure the frequency difference of 104 terahertz, over a million comb modes between these two lasers. To get such a broad comb, they pre-chirped the pulse and sent it into 2 meters of regular silica fiber, and it was broadened through processes of self-phase modulation and four-wave mixing into this broad comb here. So we're now able to measure the difference of optical frequencies with mode-lock lasers, but we cannot yet measure the absolute optical frequencies. It's fairly easy to control the spacing between the comb modes just by controlling the laser's repetition frequency, but there was no way to easily measure and control the common offset of all the comb modes. That offset is due to dispersion in the laser cavity. Because of dispersion, the laser pulses which travel at the group velocity gradually slip in phase with respect to the underlying optical carrier wave which travels at the group velocity. And in the time between one pulse to the next, that phase slippage amounts to this value of delta phi. So therefore, in the time between two pulses, the carrier wave oscillates a very large integer number of cycles, plus this extra fraction of a cycle given by this delta phi. And so that means that the frequency of the carrier wave is a large integer times the repetition frequency plus this offset frequency, which is given by this expression here. So we have a way of, we know what the offset frequency is caused by, but yet we still don't have a way of controlling it or measuring it and controlling it. The solution was provided by a new type of optical frequency, a photonic crystal fiber, a certain type of fiber. This fiber is sometimes called microstructured fiber, so I might call it that once in a while. It consisted of a very small core, about 2 microns in diameter. And because the core was so small, when the light was focused into it, the peak intensities of the light were extremely high. The other thing about this fiber was that the dispersion could be engineered so that the dispersion at the wavelength of the laser was either zero or it could be even anomalous. And what that meant was that as the if you sent a short pulse into the fiber, it would remain short as it propagated down the fiber. It wouldn't disperse out. So it would maintain high peak powers. And so the combination of the high peak intensities and the long interaction length resulted in what Jan Hall refers to as serious nonlinearity. And that generates a very broad comb of frequencies that can extend to over an optical octave. So if you have a comb that extends over an octave, you can use this technique to determine the offset frequency. You just take the nth comb element and frequency double it in a nonlinear crystal and mix it with the 2nth comb element on a photodiode, and the resulting heterodyne beat frequency is just given by this expression, which is equal to the offset frequency, which is what we want to know. In reality, a whole bunch of comb elements here that are all within the acceptance band of the nonlinear crystal will get doubled and beat against the comb elements out here, and that gives you a very strong signal. So you can often easily get 30 dB or greater signal to noise on these on the offset beat. So this is how an optical frequency comb is built in order to stabilize the repetition the comb spacing and the offset frequency so that the comb can be used for measuring optical frequencies. The comb spacing is equal to the laser repetition frequency, and that's controlled by changing the length of the cavity by using a piezoelectric translator that supports one of the mirrors. The offset frequency is controlled by controlling the laser power, which affects the dispersion in the crystal, and that shifts around the offset frequency. So when after you've locked both of these two frequencies, F-rep and F-naught, to a cesium reference, then you know all the frequencies of all the comb elements to the same relative uncertainty as the cesium reference itself. And then it's a simple matter to measure the frequency of an unknown laser simply by beating its frequency against a nearby comb element and measuring it on a frequency counter. And the importance of this, the development of the self-referencing comb, was recognized with the 2005 Nobel Prize in Physics awarded to John Hall from JILA and Theodore Hansch from MPQ. At NRC, we have two optical combs. The first one that was built was our Thai sapphire-based comb. The laser and the microstructured fiber are located in this airtight box. I've dispersed the spectrum with a diffraction grating, so you can see the rainbow of colors produced by the fiber. This is the fiber here. You can see that most of the supercontinuum was generated in just the first few centimeters of the fiber. Our second fiber-based comb, our second comb, was a fiber-based comb, which was developed in collaboration with David Jones and his postdoc, Jay Jiang, at UBC. And this was finished in about 2006. Fiber combs have become probably the most popular type of comb now. And the reason is that since the light is confined most of the time in a fiber, they don't have issues so much with coming out of alignment. And so therefore, they can be used for long-term unattended operation, and you can, which you need in order to average down optical frequency measurements. So we've used our comb primarily to measure the frequency of our single-trap strontium ion standard. And this shows the results over the years. This is our original chain measurement and some Thai sapphire measurements. We didn't have the ion as well evaluated back, or the ion standard as well evaluated. So some of these error bar, the reason they're so big is because of the standard itself and not because of the optical frequency measurement. Our best measurements now have an uncertainty of about 0.8 hertz or 2 parts in 10 to the 15, and that's limited by our traceability to the SI second at NRC right now. And we hope that probably within maybe a year and a half, we'll be able to reduce this uncertainty by about a factor of 5 when we get our new cesium fountain clock operated and fully evaluated. The standard itself has improved quite significantly over the years. It has a current evaluated systematic uncertainty of only about 1 part in 10 to the 17, and that's limited by black body shifts, and we're hoping to reduce that to a few parts in 10 to the 18 fairly shortly. So there's many applications of optical frequencies combs. I've listed a bunch here. In the area of precision measurement, they've been used for measuring fundamental physical constants and looking at their temporal stability. When you combine them with optical frequency standards, you can use them for improved Earth and space-based navigation. And if you lock a optical frequency comb to a high-quality ultra-stable laser or optical frequency standard, it becomes a source of RF that has better stability and phase noise than RF from any other source that's available. The gravitational redshift at the surface of the Earth amounts to about 1 part 10 to the 16 for every meter of elevation change. And so if you have an optical standard with an uncertainty of around 1 part 10 to the 18, you'd be able to perform relativistic geodesy and hydrology at uncertainty levels that would be better than what you can achieve by any other means. There's been some recent measurements done in Europe between various labs where they've connected the labs together with phase-stabilized fibers, and part of the difficulty in comparing their standards was in the knowledge of knowing the exact altitude of all the various standards in the different countries. It's very likely that an optical standard will replace the cesium standard in a future redefinition of the second, and so therefore we're going to need optical combs to transfer that optical frequency standard, which will be the new second, to the RF and to use it to measure other optical standards. Now, optical frequency standards themselves have progressed to the state where their current levels of uncertainty are only a few parts in 10 to the 18. This is about a factor of 100 better than the best current cesium fountain clocks, which is around 1 to 2 parts in 10 to the 16. But where the optical frequency standards really shine is in their stability, because what this does is that the stability is such that if you make a measurement with this optical frequency standard, the data will average down to the evaluated systematic uncertainty in a period of only hours or even minutes, rather than the days or even weeks that are required to make measurements with the cesium fountain clocks. So the accuracy of atomic clocks has dropped by about a factor of 10, or the uncertainty has dropped by about a factor of 10 per decade over the last 60 years. The cesium standards are all shown in blue here, and after about 1990, they were all the best ones were the cesium fountain clocks, which are cold atom clocks. The best of those are now a couple of cryogenic clocks, I think operate at liquid nitrogen temperatures, and they have evaluated uncertainties of about 1 to 2 parts in 10 to the 16. On the other hand, the optical frequency standards have shown very rapid progress and are now have uncertainties that are about a factor of 100 better than the uncertainty of the current definition of the SI second standard, which is the cesium standard. So the situation with the second is almost identical to that of the meter back in, prior to the meter's redefinition in 1983, in that if you want to make measurements with the current second standard, those measurements are limited in their uncertainty by the uncertainty in the standard itself. So I'm going to finish there and thank my co-workers who over the years have contributed to the optical frequency measurements and the development of optical frequency standards, especially the single trapped ion standard, and also the people who provide us with the traceability to the SI second in our laboratory. We've had a number of postdocs, visitors, and students, and I'd also like to thank David Jones and Jay Jang for their work with us on the FiberComb. And finally, Bob Windler from OFS, who provided the microstructured or photonic crystal fiber that we used in our first comb. So thank you.
Start off. Is there anything you miss about the old chains compared to the biggest comps?
No, not really. No, it was a high stress day. You would fill the lasers in the morning, and you would just hope you'd get the signals on the point contact diodes to make the measurements, and that everything else was working at that night. And you only had a limited amount of time because we ran our CO2 laser regulators on batteries. And the batteries would go dead after probably about 6 hours. So.
Is there a limit to how low the
oxygen can be? I don't think so, but the various standards for optical frequency standards that have been chosen have often been chosen because they have very small systematic shifts of one type or another. I think the ytterbium that is shown here, this ytterbium here, it's an octopole transition in ytterbium ion, and it has, I believe, a very low sensitivity to blackbody shifts. So right now, our ion is limited by blackbody shifts. I think even this one, this strontium lattice, was the reason they were able to bring their uncertainty down was they had got a better handle on the blackbody shift. And part of that's not just the theoretical shift coefficients. It's the measurement of the temperature that the ion's seeing, because you have to take into account what its environment is. And in the case of our ion, we have these electrodes which have little insulators in them, and the insulators get heated up because we apply about 12 megahertz to this trap. And so the ion sees these warm insulators, but we don't know how warm they are. So that's why we have this uncertainty. But I don't know of any fundamental limit to the uncertainty.
Is there any room for experimental bias or anything like this, or is it really purely mechanical, the measurement?
Well, there's always probably a room for bias, but oh, you mean like these? Like on these? No, they haven't built two of them to compare them against each other. To even compare them against each other at this level would be difficult, because just expansion of your optical table starts to give you shifts of 2 parts in 10 to the 18 for a very reasonable amount of, that's a Doppler shift. So these are evaluated uncertainties using the measured shift coefficients that you've measured and applying them to how uncertain you are about the value that goes into that coefficient, essentially. So we'll only know for sure when we build two of these and ship them around the world and probably compare them against each other. You can't compare them through GPS methods. You're limited to a few parts in 10 to the 16 if you're doing that. So you'd have to either have a stabilized fiber link, which is only possible over in Europe, not over across the ocean, or you have to bring a portable device from one lab to another.